Okay, here we go, hour two of our little show. As I mentioned to Mr. Pete in an email, and also to you, Adam Bergstrom, who's a good friend and great researcher, and he's on our show several times a month, even more sometimes, and he's a fan and knows a lot about the work of Mr. Ray Pete. He's on the line. Adam, you there?
I am here.
There you are.
Yes,
Ray Pete is a PhD in biology from University of Oregon. His specialization in physiology. The schools he's taught in include University of Oregon, Urbana College, Montana State University, National College of Naturopathic Medicine. He started his work with progesterone and related hormones in 1968, and in papers in physiological chemistry and physics. I mean, he's got such an incredible background and very well-respected around the world, Ray Pete, and he's on the line. Mr. Pete, good morning.
Good morning.
How you doing? It's been a while.
Yeah, I guess 5 years.
Has it been 5 years?
Yeah,
yeah. What are you most passionate about these days, Mr. Ray Pete, and your work? And say, by the way, Ray, say hi to Adam Bergstrom.
Oh, yeah, hi. I've read his stuff on the yellow fat disease. Very, very great work.
Thank you, Ray. Thank you very much. Thank you for turning me on to the concept, because the first time I ever heard the words was out of your mouth.
Oh.
And you mentioned it on Patrick's show, too.
Oh, really?
The last time, yes, you did.
When did you first get turned on to the yellow fat thing, Ray?
Oh, in the 1940s, a family friend of ours was a chinchilla farmer. And he found that fish were poisoning his chinchillas. But that made me check the idea of essential fatty acids. And at that time, in the late 40s and early 50s, any time someone mentioned the idea of essential fatty acids, it was very tentative, because in Texas, one of the research institutes, I don't remember the exact name of it, 1946, demonstrated that the so-called fatty acid deficiency disease was really a vitamin B6 deficiency, because they could feed them a fat-free diet, cause the scaly skin symptoms and so on, and cure the disease with a supplement of vitamin B6 without any fat added. So I sort of grew up with the concept that the fatty acid essentiality is, first it was a mistake, and then it turned into a fraud. And then in the 1970s, I saw research in which they fed saturated fat or highly polyunsaturated fats or a mixture to rats through their whole lifetime. And they found that it wasn't the quantity of fat that made them obese, it was the degree of unsaturation. So that the ones that ate saturated fat, such as coconut oil, were lean at the end of their lives, no matter how much they ate. And the ones that ate only polyunsaturated fat were fat at the end of their lives, even if they had a low-fat diet.
Now, Adam, you jump in anytime. You don't need me. You can just jump in. We're just having a combo here. So these are the classic things, Ray Pete, called PUFAs, right? Polyunsaturated fatty acids.
Highly unsaturated fatty acids, omega-3s mainly, DHA, EPA, ALA.
Those are so sensitive to oxygen degradation that people have checked the blood content after someone eats a fatty fish and finds that very little of them even reach the bloodstream. And when they do, they're an oxidized breakdown product. The great majority of the fat is degraded by the time it gets into your bloodstream.
Really? So overall, then, we humans, you don't think, Ray Pete, we need to be eating any fish at all?
Only because of the trace minerals that are reliably in seafood.
Mm-hmm.
Selenium and iodine, for example, aren't reliable if you eat foods grown only in one locality. you can become deficient in a particular trace mineral.
In your opinion, any fish better than others to eat if you're going to have a little fish?
The low-fat fish and the shellfish. Shellfish are great sources of copper because they generally don't use iron. Oysters are high in iron, but squid is very good. It's low in iron and high in copper and has selenium and iodine and other trace minerals. Cod and sole are low-fat fish that are safe.
Cod and sole. So these fatty fish, you eat them before they even get to where they're going, they start causing the body a problem?
If you take, say, a fish oil supplement and then look in your bloodstream, there's enough of the oxidized fat already to suppress the immune system. That's why they use them as anti-inflammatories. But the trouble is that they accumulate and create progressive suppression of your immune system. And people talk about them being required for the brain structure, because if you look at an adult's brain, it's full of fish oil equivalents. But a newborn, there have been many publications saying that when they check the brain of a newly born, say a miscarriage, they find that the brain is very low in polyunsaturated fatty acids. And so they say you must supplement pregnant women with fish oil or the equivalent, because babies are being born with a brain deficiency of PUFA. But in France, there was a study in which they did give a PUFA supplement to pregnant women, figuring that they would advance brain development. And so they gave a sound test to the woman's abdomen to measure the baby's response. They found that the babies learned more slowly in utero if they had extra PUFA added to the diet, and they were born with smaller brains. And that shouldn't have been done in humans, because already in the 1960s and 70s, experiments were showing that animals, if the mother was fed a diet high in unsaturated fat, the babies were born small-brained and slow learners. If they were low in PUFA but fed, for example, saturated fat, the babies had bigger brains and learned faster.
Are any of these unsaturated fats, like olive oil, in your opinion, are good food?
It's about 8 or 10 or 11% PUFA. The rest of it is very good fat.
Okay.
So if you hold it down to 1 or 2 teaspoons per day, you're safe.
Yeah.
And all during the growth time up to the age of 20, the body is diluting the PUFA in the diet. So the brain isn't seriously impaired until about the age of 20. When you stop growing in size and volume, the brain and other tissues begin increasing their concentration of PUFA. So from 20 to the mid-40s, the brain is becoming more and more polyunsaturated, and so more at risk of stress. When you're under stress, you release these any of the stored PUFA into the bloodstream, where they can become oxidized and toxic.
So in the fish oil and the EPA DHA arena, not only what you're talking about, isn't there also the issues of these things being rancid, the way they're produced and stored and such?
That gives a head start on the problem.
Yeah, wow.
But even if you eat the most perfectly fresh PUFA, by the time it reaches your stomach, it's deteriorating, and then when it gets into the tissue, it's farther along, and some of it reaches your brain and is stored for years, but then every night your brain is renewing itself considerably. But unfortunately, during the night, your free fatty acids in the blood coming out of your fat tissues rise. And so the brain is trying to renew itself, but what it finds in your bloodstream by the time you're 40 is polyunsaturated fatty acids that add to the damage of the brain. So that every night when you're over the age of 40, your brain is at risk of deteriorating faster.
Oh, great. That's all we need, right? That's great. Ray Peters with us, and Adam Bergstrom's co-hosting the show today because he's done a lot of research with Mr. Pete, Patrick Timpone, Ray, Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. If you'd like to join the show, Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Adam, what's the most fascinating thing you've kind of picked up on the whole yellow fat thing that you were first alerted to with Ray Pete?
I found references of it also causing brown heart disease, and it was known that cod liver oil was a cause of it at about the time of the Civil War. And there are several references, maybe about a half a dozen or close to a dozen that I've found from that time. So this has been known for a long time. And also, people forget that in 1982, in the book Life Extension by Dirk Pearson and Sandy Shaw, they basically told you to walk big circles around omega-3s and mentioned specifically DHA and EPA. And the author of Never Cry Wolf, I believe, Farley Mowat, he also recommended avoiding fish, and that the Inuit avoided fish, and it was the government that gave them nets. The Canadian government gave them nets, and they wouldn't use it because they knew if they ate just those fish, those cold water fish, they would die. And that is in his book about the Inuit, the people of the deer, I believe it's called.
Fascinating. Right, Ray Pete, so the DHA, EPA molecule or whatever it is, do we need any of this, like just go straight to some seaweeds or, I don't know, something? Do we need it? And do we get it in other places other than fish oils and stuff?
No, if we eat only sugar, for example, for calories, we synthesize the monounsaturated fat, such as is the main fat of olive oil, oleic acid. And from oleic acid, whether we get it from a good food like olive oil or make it from our own sugar or starch in our diet, that can be unsaturated. And the normal polyunsaturated fat in our brain at birth is made from glucose by first making oleic acid and then unsaturating that. And these are omega minus 9 polyunsaturated fats. They're our natural fat. An Australian researcher tested, he found an easy source of omega minus 9 fatty acids and found that they are very powerfully anti-inflammatory, and they don't break down and oxidize easily because they have 9 carbons at the end that are saturated, which are very stable. And the acid at the other end is a stabilizing factor. So omega minus 9 fats are natural and concentrate in the brain and give good brain function and good stability against oxidation. The whole concept of essential fatty acids, which was disproved in Texas in 1946, it was brought back in the 1950s when the food oil industry found they had lots of cottonseed oil was the first. It was a byproduct of the cotton industry. And they were polluting the country with the waste cottonseed, and they found that they could extract the oil, make people eat it as a food lubricant, basically. Mm-hmm. There was a great campaign around 1950 50 to sell Wesson oil, cottonseed oil.
Oh, yeah.
They gave recipes for making special pastries and cakes mm-hmm. using that instead of butter. So it was all an advertising ploy starting in the 1950s.
Yes.
And people accepted the advertising, and people grew up believing in essential fatty acid concept. So when they went to medical school and did research, it became the official doctrine. By the 1960s, people were already being poisoned by eating their cottonseed oil and soy oil and so on. The medical industry had convinced itself that there was such a thing as essential fatty acids, and that they were protective, was the advertising line. They would protect you against cholesterol and saturated fats.
Yeah.
And so they put several hundred veterans in Los Angeles on a diet with only the vegetable polyunsaturated fats, or a fairly normal diet containing some butter and cream and lard and so on, not really a saturated fat, but just an average diet. At the end of 8 years, there were three times as many cancer deaths in the group on vegetable oil
wow.
as on the normal diet.
Wow.
And so they stopped the study and said, well, it doesn't protect against heart disease, so we'll stop. But they didn't advertise the fact that it greatly increased the cancer mortality, which had been known in animal studies already, but the medical industry fell for the food oil advertising line.
I grew up in the 50s, and I know Adam probably did. I don't know how old you are, Ray, but boy, I can remember the Wesson oil commercials. Boy, they were everywhere.
Yeah.
Wow, everywhere. So in general, with good sources, most saturated fats are just fine to consume for us?
The trouble is that even the good fats, olive oil has 8 or 10% PUFA, butter has 2 or 3%, even coconut oil has 2 or 3%.
Yeah.
And these are, the cells don't prefer to oxidize those because they're dangerous and poison the mitochondria, so they're packed away in fat cells. Highly selected so-called saturated fat diet, we're putting some of these in the storage, and they're getting into the brain and fat tissues. And so by the time a person is 50, even if they've been reasonable in their diet choices, they're still going to have too much of the PUFA in their body. And that makes you more susceptible to any stress when they come out and poison you more intensely.
Wow.
Go
ahead, Adam.
I was going to say it's how you make lipofuscin, too. And lipofuscin now has been shown to be not just a passive waste product, but it groups into iron, zinc, and other toxic metals and uses them against the human body and any body, except if you're a salmon listening to this show, then DHA is okay.
In 1970, when I was working on my dissertation, trying to understand why hamsters aged and became sterile halfway through their lifetime, I found that their uterus was accumulating lipofuscin, and so I studied it, and it becomes like a little oxygen-consuming it's a brown speck in the cell, but it binds iron and other heavy metals, as you said, and acts that acts like an artificial hemoglobin that delivers oxygen to reducing agents, and so it produces the breakdown product peroxide and consumes oxygen before it can get to your mitochondria. So you seem to be consuming oxygen, but you're not using it. When I was doing that, just for fun, I bought a quart of a vegetable oil. Might have been soy oil or one of the standard liquid oils, and put a clear plastic tube in the neck of the bottle and sealed it, and put the other end of the tube in a glass of water, and came back a few hours later, and it was sucking up water. I'd been using that method to measure the oxygen consumption of hamster uterus and so on, and I found that the bottle of vegetable oil was sucking up oxygen in the process of degrading itself. It was consuming oxygen just like an animal would. So when you get it in your body, it competes with your mitochondria in a purely wasteful, destructive process.
Wow. Right, Pete and Adam Bergstrom and Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. Let's move on. We got a lot of emails, and we're going to get to them, but I wanted to get Ray Pete's opinion, because it's been a long time since I've talked to. And by the way, it's raypete.com. You check out his work, and he has a lot of stuff there. So much has been talked about of late, of the grains and the lectins and all this stuff, and they're not for us, and human conception and whatever. Give us your opinion on what you think, just grains in general, and let's consider that whenever you're talking about it, we'll be talking about good, well-farmed, organic, whatever it be, rice or wheat or whatever. What's your take on all the grain thing that's going on in the world today with all the...
In the 1960s, I was living and working in Mexico. I had a school there, and I got interested in how people could be fed economically. And grains are a very cheap source of starch, but they come with a variety of defensive toxins. For a plant, its leaves are important. Cows and insects eat their leaves, and so they put some toxins in their leaves, but they can regenerate the leaves. But their seeds are essential for the next generation to survive. So the worst toxins that a plant can produce are put into the seeds as defense against predators. And so the traditional societies, like the indigenous Mexican preparation of any grain, was to soak it in lye. Lye or lime. In China and other countries, the same thing was practiced. If they used grain, they would have ashes left over from their fires, and so they would put the ashes in and boil the grains with acid and the or with lye, alkali. It would break down the starches and the storage proteins, the gluten-like chemicals. The native Mexican diet based on corn, no one was getting pellagra. But in the South, when people started growing corn, they didn't know the traditional lye or lime treatment. And so pellagra became an epidemic through the southern states because of the corn in the diet. And corn is one of the less toxic grains. Any grain should be highly processed, such as with lime or lye, to degrade the toxins. And just soaking a fresh grain, if you soak it for a day or two, that activates enzymes, and turning it into basically a sprout, then the toxins are reduced. The root and the shoot will have some toxins, but the worst toxins are in the seed itself.
So if one wants to consume a good organic brown rice or something like that, just soak it for 24 hours is the best way to do it before cooking it?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It loses some of its characteristic taste, but it's a lot safer.
Uh-huh. Here's an email for you all from Lindsay. What thyroid medication does Ray Pete recommend for hypothyroid, and why is there such a scarcity of natrethroid?
It's a fairly long story. I've got some articles on my website about it, but until about 1940, the agriculture department hadn't required that it be removed from meats. The waste from the slaughterhouses used to be put into hamburger and such. In 1940 or 42, the agriculture department declared that the thyroid gland had to be sold to the armor meat company to produce thyroid hormone by desiccating the gland, removing the fat, adding glucose to it, and putting it in tablets. But until that time, anyone who was eating a traditional meat-based diet, for example, in Germany, they would put the thyroid gland and other parts into sausages. And anyone that made traditional fish or chicken soup, the neck and the thyroid and the head would go into the soup. So everyone was getting thyroid as a natural supplement. After 1942, it was by law not permitted in food. So at that point, we became dependent on a supplement. It's our natural antidote to the accumulation of polyunsaturated fats in the tissues, because those, as they build up in the blood, block every function of the thyroid hormone. They block the production of it in your gland, the transport in your blood, and the reception and use of it in your mitochondria. So PUFA are the great enemy of thyroid, and if we aren't allowed to get it in our natural chicken soup or fish soup, then we're dependent on getting it as a supplement. And Armour made a great supplement for almost 100 years. Then they sold their company to Revlon, the cosmetics company, and the price went up about tenfold. And in a series of sales, the pills went from less than 1 cent each up to close to a dollar each, simply as a matter of financial arrangements. But still, Armour has gone, with the new owners, Armour has gone through a series of problems because they changed the formula, added various junk to it, but insisted hasn't changed because it's still called Armour Thyroid. But there, since then, other companies have taken over more or less the traditional Armour formula, but it depends on who they are getting their glandular material from. The Armour descendant, Forest Pharmaceuticals, said several years ago that they were using the raw material of the gland to extract thyrocalcitonin to regulate calcium. That used to be a part of the natural thyroid supplement. So now it's hard to know whether your thyroid glandular has been pre-extracted, losing the calcitonin component. So since the 1990s, I've been using a product made in Mexico called Sino Plus, which imitates the Armour formula. The Armour company made a synthetic equivalent of the glandular and called it Thyrolar. And that formula was exactly copied by a couple other companies, but Sino Plus continues to make the Armour equivalent in a synthetic form. When I started buying it, 100 tablets cost 60 cents, and now they're selling for about $20 for a bottle, but still it's cheaper. The equivalent made in the U.S. is close to $100 for that many tablets.
Ray Pete is with us, and Adam called back on the landline. We were getting lots of weird noises on your Skype. Thanks for doing that. And, you know, Mr. Pete, I've been real curious about, let's see if I have this right. Well, you've been a kind of a proponent, and I think it has this thyroid functionality to it of a faster pulse rate, meaning actually been more healthful, like a 70 beats per minute rather than 60, and an indication of thyroid function. Is that correct?
Yeah, there were some studies in the 1980s of various things related to heart rate. They found that brain function closely corresponded to heart rate. They looked at kids in school and high school and saw that their grade average corresponded to their heart rate. And that led them to look at people with pacemakers. And they would give a person with pacemakers set at 70 beats a mental test, and then they would just turn the regulator up and give them an 85 per minute heart rate, and their mental functions all improved. There were studies that showed that if your blood pressure and heart rate increased every year a little bit on average, you were doing well. But they saw that if, for example, at the age of 70 or so, your pulse rate stopped increasing or even started decreasing, those people didn't have a long life expectancy.
Really?
As long as things were tightening up with age, in effect compensating for the increased inefficiency because of the PUFA storage, if you could keep increasing your blood delivery, you were making up for that inefficiency from the stored lipofuscin.
I'll be done. Yeah, the reason I ask is because, you know, mine's about 55 or 60, and if I get 65 or so at night, Mr. Pete, I mean, I can tell if I'm above 60, and I don't feel good. It feels kind of anxious and feels like a body doesn't want to sleep. It's almost, you know what I'm saying?
Have you checked your temperature at those times? If your hands are cold as you're increasing your heart rate, that means you're running on adrenaline, which is not good.
Oh, okay.
Your hands should be warm, and your oral temperature shouldn't be too much above your hand temperature. Keeping your adrenaline low will let your heart rate correspond to your metabolic rate. And when you get your temperature up so that your temperature rises to about 98 when you wake up,
right,
and then gets up to 98.5 or 6 or 7 when you're moving around, then your heart will have a corresponding increase in rate. And that goes with also an increased stroke volume of the heart, so it delivers more blood per beat. If you're having high adrenaline or other stress hormones, your heart is going to have a short stroke, not deliver very much per beat, and so it has to beat faster. And that leads to inefficiency and tissue stress.
So if you get the body temperature up, am I hearing you correctly, the heart may beat a little faster, but that's you won't feel the anxiety because of it?
Yeah.
You're saying?
Yeah. When your metabolism is going at a good high rate, mm-hmm. you're producing carbon dioxide in proportion to your oxygen consumption. And the carbon dioxide has a relaxing, constructive sedative effect.
That's what, Adam, you talk a lot about the carbon dioxide.
Yes, definitely. I got the information from Dr. Ray P.
Okay.
And by the way, let me add that we're just discussing the snowflake on the tip of the iceberg, because Dr. Ray P. is a true polymath. He's a Renaissance man. I recommend you go to his website and read his numerous blogs. He also sells a newsletter. And I don't know when his books are coming back online, but he writes books also.
Well, good plug there. Ray Pete, stay right there, Mr. Pete. We're going to do a couple commercials, okay?
Okay.
You guys stay right there. Wow, what fun. Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. We have lots of emails here. I'm not sure how long Mr. Pete can hang out. I'll ask him when we go back, and let's do a few things here, and then we'll be right back. Stay right there. Previously, we talked with Dr. Rulin Zhu about using Pearlseum on your teeth.
You have to experience it. You'll believe it.
Yeah, you do. That's what I've been saying to my listeners. I keep saying, can't even explain this. Just buy it. Just click on it, buy some. Trust me. Just trust me. And you're going to like the way your teeth look. That's what I keep telling.
Dentists, they did an experiment on their clients, and they literally prove, and they literally show the picture every day. You know, when they take it in a few days, their tooth literally become, like you said, like a pearl, and it looks so beautiful and really white and shiny. Yeah, it really works, and it's also scientifically proven by the experiment. And he literally proved it is not only good for your teeth, he also proved it's also good for your gum.
Try some of this Pearlseum. I think you're going to love it. You can try it internally as well. Helps with sleep. Great way to get absorbable calcium, and also on your face. You'll see the green ad there, the beautiful green container. Get the capsules or the powder. Pearlseum. Click and order. OneRadioNetwork.com. Previously with Andrew Gost, I asked him why would someone want to buy coins from his company?
So if you don't know coins, you better know your coin dealer. And, you know, you shouldn't buy coins from someone who isn't well-known registered dealer. So if they're an NGC dealer, they're registered with NGC. If they're a PCGS dealer, they're registered with PCGS. Ask questions. Don't just, here's 10 grand or 50 grand or 150 grand. I just want to buy coins, let me know what I'm getting. And no, that's not how an intelligent investor does it. And we do not let you do that. So if you're not willing to learn about the coins that you're buying, maybe you should find another coin firm. Don't call this one, because we're going to insist that you know why and how a coin is rare. And once you know that, then I think you can take that knowledge into the marketplace and make intelligent investment decisions.
Aha, what a concept, intelligent investment decisions. I've known Andrew for 25 years. He's the real deal. His company, STL 800-468-2646. Give him a call if you're interested. 800-468-2646. Once again, our just heartfelt thanks to all of you in the outpouring of love and affection and goodwill for Andrew Gost, who left us at the mortal coil, as they say, a few days ago, suddenly brain aneurysm and just hundreds of emails and all kinds of stuff. So we really, really appreciate it. PhD in biology, University of Oregon. He's really well studied for a long, long time, as you can hear. Dr. Ray Pete, as Adam said, his website is raypete.com. You're going to find all kinds of things there, a newsletter and his books and things like that. Mr. Pete, let's stick with the temperature minute. So let's see if I'm hearing you, what you're saying. So is the body temperature, so the whole Broda Barnes idea of in the morning you want to have it, 98.6 by mouth or 97.6 under the arm, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a mechanism of thyroid only, or there must be other things going on? Does it necessarily mean you have a pokey thyroid? And if you do have a pokey thyroid, what's your best suggestions?
Broda Barnes spent most of his career up in Colorado at a high altitude, where people were seldom overheated with high humidity. And in Eugene in the summer, some days were very humid and hot, I found that hypothyroid people would come in with normal temperatures.
Uh-huh.
And I realized that even a dead person would have a fairly good temperature when the environmental temperature is very high. So
sure.
I started looking at the pulse rate as well as the temperature. And there were lots of experiments with the quality of brain function according to brain temperature as well as pulse rate and a delivery of blood, glucose and oxygen to the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Someone devised a sort of a heating pad integrated with a helmet so they could heat the head specifically. And again, they would give people mental tests, mental calculation and memory and so on. And they found that when they heated the head up to, I think, 101 degrees or slightly more, their mental abilities increased with each degree of warmer. And if you look at some fairly small-brained animals, if they have a high body temperature, like crows and parrots run around with well over 105 degrees Fahrenheit temperature, with a very small brain, they're extremely intelligent. So it isn't brain volume. It's a combination of brain volume plus the working temperature. The warmer you can stand, you don't want to force yourself to get warmer because your liver has to keep supplying a good stream of glucose, and your lungs have to regulate the oxygen delivery efficiently. But if your system can stand it, the brain works better the warmer it is.
Yeah. So again, the mechanism for cold hands and feet, is it totally thyroid or other things going on?
You can't have cold hands and feet except during stress. Emotional stress raises your adrenaline and will make your hands and feet and nose get cold. But if your thyroid is low, you experience stress almost all the time. So people run around doing their business with cold hands and feet and wonder why they're inefficient. If you're highly stressed, for example, during the night, cortisol rises to a peak in the morning because mm-hmm. your blood sugar is falling.
Mm-hmm.
Low thyroid people have extremely high cortisol in the morning, as well as sometimes adrenaline. That can make your morning temperature misleadingly warm because the cortisol is tearing down your proteiny tissues to turn them into glucose.
My goodness.
And the adrenaline will make your skin cold to increase your core temperature. So it can be misleading unless you check all of those things. The cortisol and adrenaline will show up as your increased morning temperature and heart rate. But then if you have some orange juice and milk, for example, a couple of hours later, if your temperature and pulse rate are slower, that means you're under heavy stress during the night.
Mm-hmm. So once again, it's back to our reaction to this world around us. What we call stress is a huge player in well, everything, right, Mr. B?
Everything is everything. Less stressful when your thyroid is good.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If we had a good thyroid medication possible, are you okay with people doing that for a little bit to keep your thyroid up, or you like to do other ways, recommend other ways to get the thyroid just working good?
Sure, unless you're eating a chicken neck soup or fish head soup every week, everyone really needs a certain amount of thyroid supplement by the time they're 30 or 40.
Chicken neck soup or fish head soup, really?
If you're on a farm or where you get the unprocessed.
The real good stuff, yeah.
For a while at Safeway stores, I found that chicken necks contained about 1 in 10 contained the whole thyroid gland. But mentioned that, everyone started buying it, and the Safeway stopped selling their necks because they didn't want to get in trouble with FDA, the Agriculture Department.
Oh, you mean so if you could find some good just chicken necks from Farmer's Market or something, they probably have a little thyroid in there, and just cook it soup and make some of that?
That works just like the pill.
I'll be doing. Oh, we have so many emails here. Let's see. Let's see what we can do here. Here's what I'm confused about. Many practitioners who support Dr. Pete's ideas of reducing PUFAs in favor of saturated oils always make an amendment for people that carry APOE4 gene, like myself, For this population, the advice is to lower the amount of saturated fats and use more mimosa and more and polys because they can't utilize these fats properly. They become plaque in the arteries and brain, leading to Alzheimer's. Does Mr. Pete have a comment?
At my recent newsletter on cholesterol, there were two of them, but I review the effects of PUFA on plaque and cholesterol.
Mm-hmm.
And with aging, the free cholesterol in the brain drastically decreases. People talk about the cholesterol increasing with age, but free cholesterol is decreasing because it's being bound to polyunsaturated fats, which make it toxic, and it piles up in the brain and lowers brain metabolism and brain function. And in the plaque, it's the in proportion to the PUFA attached to the cholesterol as an ester form that makes the plaque. In that newsletter, I go in detail over how the enzymes are changed under the influence of PUFA. So the plaque is strictly a matter of excess PUFA. About 40 years ago, people checked the lipofuscin content, basically yellow fat disease of the arteries,
mm-hmm.
and found that the plaque was loaded with lipofuscin, the degenerated form of free fatty acids.
So back to the PUFAs again. Just don't eat these things.
They cause plaque as well as other problems.
Mm-hmm.
That's in medical books, too.
What's that, Adam?
That is actually in medical books, that the plaque is formed of PUFAs, and they wish people to believe that they're saturated fatty acids doing it, and it's not.
For about 40 years, the Agriculture Department was listing lard as a saturated fat. So there are hundreds of publications on so-called saturated fat damage, and they were using lard as their saturated fat. And two or three years ago, it came out, someone measured the lard saturation, found that it was about 30% PUFA.
Oh, you're talking about the hydrogenated classic Crisco or something like that.
Fully hydrogenated fat is very safe. There was a Russian study of using saturated peanut oil, very hard saturated fat shortening, and they found that it reversed the aging changes in mitochondria.
Wow.
And since that time, I've shifted to using hydrogenated coconut oil, which is now available on the Internet.
And that's okay. That's good.
Very good, yeah, because it has zero PUFA.
Okay. Is it actually hydrogenated or just kind of pure or virgin coconut oil, right?
No, it's actually chemically hydrogenated.
Oh, but that's okay.
We're looking for ways to get the pure saturated form by distillation or something other than the chemical treatment. That isn't available yet, but it would be the ideal.
Mm-hmm. Any advantages over like a good coconut oil like that, or maybe a well-sourced, like a organic farmer that's doing pigs or something, and you get the real pure fat that way? Is there any preference for in your mind?
In Mexico, where out in the country where you can get chickens or pork that were fed on fruit and tortillas rather than soy and corn, they're very safe to eat.
Yeah. Here's an email. Patrick and Adam have been recently discussing Dr. Emmanuel Ribisi and his use of the periodic table to correlate catabolic and anabolic imbalances in the body. Can Mr. Pete discuss how the thyroid might be an influence to those states and how we supplementing with thyroid extract could be possibly correct the imbalances?
Ribisi was very good on noticing the effect of the day-night cycle. I started thinking about that about 40 or 50 years ago, that you have to look at the hormones in context. If your liver is in very good condition and your muscles are working right, your body should store several ounces, maybe 10 ounces of sugar, which can be drawn on during the night. And if you didn't store your sugar efficiently because you were not producing lactic, not producing carbon dioxide, but instead lactic acid, that wastes your sugar. So during the night, you run out of sugar, and that raises your adrenaline and cortisol, and you start breaking down your tissues, releasing whatever fat is stored. And that's what causes bone loss during the night, for example. If you can keep your body well stocked on sugar, then you can avoid that nighttime deterioration stress.
Well stocked with sugar, and how do we do that?
Avoiding the PUFA is mm-hmm. the essential thing, eating adequate carbohydrate. I've known people who got very sick when they were on a pure meat diet because of several reasons. Poor balance of amino acids, but mainly the high phosphate content, mm-hmm. Creates stress and increases the cortisol and adrenaline. Mm-hmm.
Gail writes that sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night and, like Patrick talks about sometimes, this is funny, have some kind of a carbohydrate and it just puts me back to sleep like a little baby. And Gail, she wants to know what's going on in my body when it reacts like that to a carbohydrate.
Salt has a similar effect because it's needed to absorb the sugar from your intestine. And when you have too much PUFA in your body, that poisons the ability to produce carbon dioxide from sugar. And so in making lactic acid from glucose, you use several times more glucose per minute than when you're making carbon dioxide. It just churns through the stored glycogen in your body. So within an hour or two of going to sleep, your body rings the alarm that you need more sugar, turns on the stress hormones. And so if you have sometimes just a little salty snack will do it because that makes your intestine absorb the sugar more efficiently and lower stress hormones. But for example, a tablespoon of sugar in a glass of milk, could be honey, will usually put a person back to sleep for a couple hours.
But you said actually a salty snack would do the same thing.
Very often it does. I've seen people with hyperactive kids who never wanted to go to bed, gave them a little bit of salty consomme or something and just right out like they'd been given a shot of morphine or something.
I'll be darned. Here is Mark. He's in Tennessee. Whenever I drink coffee with sugar, when I drink orange juice, I develop slight heartburn for a short period of time. How might I alleviate this problem? What could be the cause?
Good oranges are very important. Much of the orange juice that's sold commercially is from unripe oranges, and if they accidentally happen to get ripe oranges, they add acid to it to make it taste, taste like people expect. So good sweet oranges are very easy on the stomach, and coffee, the various brands vary, but coffee is always somewhat acidic, and it's much easier on the stomach if you put some good heavy cream in it as well as sugar.
And that kind of smooths out coffee, doesn't it, the heavy cream?
Makes it taste better and is much easier on the stomach, and you absorb the caffeine more slowly.
Mm-hmm. Overall, you're okay generally. I'm sorry, I haven't read a lot of your work. Just get so busy here, but just with good dairy and cheese and things like that, and you think the body's okay with all those things?
Cheese and eggs and milk and occasional shellfish. I think the average person benefits from having liver two or three times a month because so many of the foods are unreliable for nutritional content.
Shellfish has a lot of cholesterol, but we want to keep our cholesterol up, though, right, Mr. P?
The cosmetics companies have caught on to the fact that old people's free cholesterol decreases tremendously. The skin aging is basically a cholesterol deficiency syndrome, the way Alzheimer's disease, it gets the fatty acid ester, which is toxic, but the real cholesterol is down by about 50% in aged skin. The cosmetics companies are building on experiments which showed that if you add cholesterol to the skin, it restores the cell function. Live cells come back. The dead flaky cells aren't produced when there's adequate cholesterol. So they're actually adding cholesterol to the cosmetic creams.
No, Peter.
That biologically is very appropriate because the reason old people need more vitamin D is because vitamin D is made when sunlight hits the cholesterol in the skin. And if you're old, the skin has only half as much cholesterol as a young person, so you produce half as much vitamin D. So an old person just doesn't, they need twice as much sunlight as a young person.
Oh. A lot of studies we've recently seen, Mr. Peter, out of Europe about the higher the cholesterol number for people 60, 70, and 80, the longer they live.
There were studies in the U.S. too in which people in rest homes and such, they looked at their cholesterol and checked how long they lived. 250, 260 were the longest living. It's the same idea. It's if you look at how much progesterone an ovary produces, it's exactly proportional to the amount of cholesterol in the blood going into the ovary. Same with your adrenals and brain, any tissue. It makes its hormones like DHEA, pregnenolone, and progesterone by converting cholesterol straight into the steroid hormone. And to do that, thyroid is the catalyst.
Do you have a number that you go by that you'd like to see the minimum cholesterol so people can do the whole hormone thing, testosterone and the rest of it?
180 is good for a middle-aged person, but by the time a person is 50, according to the Framingham study, the incidence of Alzheimer's disease is higher in people who are not over 200 in their cholesterol.
Patrick, this is an interesting question from Leroy. Patrick recently had a good friend that had a brain aneurysm and just left. Can Mr. Pete explain the overall mechanism of strokes, whether they be in the brain or other parts of the body?
Experimenters have produced aneurysms in as short a time as 1 hour, giving the angiotensin hormone. You produce angiotensin when the kidneys aren't getting what they need. The kidneys send out a signal, renin, which causes many tissues to produce angiotensin, and the angiotensin-converting enzymes, the inhibitors, are used as drugs. That's one of the few drugs that has a logical basis. If you give an animal an overdose of angiotensin, it immediately damages the artery so much that it has an aneurysm. And if you block that angiotensin, you can reverse aneurysms, simply restoring the energy to the blood vessels. And you don't produce excess angiotensin if your kidneys are getting the blood supply they need, the nourishment they need. And so thyroid and a diet adequate and free of PUFA is what keeps your kidneys getting the nutrients they need so they don't raise your angiotensin.
So that could be the connection with the kidneys and the filtration and the classic high blood pressure and the strokes?
Salt is another thing that guarantees adequate blood volume, perfusing the kidneys so they don't produce those toxic angiotensin reactants. Salt lowers your aldosterone produced by the adrenals, and aldosterone works parallel to the angiotensin, causing tissue degeneration. There are now drugs coming out to lower or oppose aldosterone to protect the failing heart. High aldosterone is produced by chronic deficiency of sodium in your diet, and aldosterone causes fibrosis, aging of all of the tissues, but the heart is usually the first one that shows up the effect as heart failure. So the low-sodium diet is one of the most dangerous things.
And that's why some people, I think, have a good experience maybe using salt before bed, even like a half a teaspoon just straight away with sleep. That makes sense, huh?
Yeah, even a fourth of a teaspoon is very helpful.
Yeah. Here's an email from Robert. Does Ray Pete still drink 3 quarts of milk a day? And what are the benefits of milk? Are you still drinking 3 quarts of milk a day?
Yeah. Sometimes 20, 30 years ago, I drank a gallon a day.
Really?
The problem with grains and leaves is that the plants produce these defensive toxins. And if a cow ate those and didn't process them in some way, the cow would succumb to all of those toxins. But the cow has an extra stomach that lets bacteria and protozoa and yeast process out those toxins. So it's a very complex chemical detoxifying process before the cow absorbs the protein and amino acids and sugars into the blood. The plant material has been very detoxified, so you're getting all of those nutrients multiply filtered before it gets into the bloodstream, and from the bloodstream to the udder, it's filtered again. So it's the most highly refined food that we can get economically.
And I suspect you're talking about raw, really good grass-fed and all that stuff.
Yeah, but even low-fat pasteurized milk, still the best food available, even if it isn't organic and raw.
No kidding. Really, I'm surprised to hear you say that, because, I mean, there's so much negative stuff said about Mr. Pete about, pasteurizing milk and all of that.
Yeah, it's better when it's unpasteurized.
Sure.
The whole milk is super food, but just 1% milk from the supermarket is better than most alternatives.
Steve writes in, fats are fun, nothing like butter, coconut oil. How about wheat germ oil? I heard it helps build the myelin sheaths. Is that true? And what are the positive or negative effects of consuming wheat germ oil? Is it actually made from wheat? Or if so, would there be concern about the source?
The samples that I tried 30 or 40, 50 years ago always were chokingly rancid, dark color, and deteriorated by oxygen because it's so highly polyunsaturated. I think it's a very toxic oil. But it does have the vitamin E in it, so if you've refined it to any degree, then it is a source of vitamin E. But I think it's very dangerous because of how easily it gets rancid. It's the same with lecithin. Commercial lecithin generally ranges from yellow to brown to black, depending on how deteriorated it is. Fresh lecithin is pure white. and it's the polyunsaturated fats turning to pre-yellow fat. Turns yellow right in the bottle.
Lots of lecithin and really good range eggs. You like eggs?
Yeah. If the chickens have been fed,
good stuff.
Good stuff. Yeah. If they range in a pasture, and in Mexico, people feed their chickens tortillas and such things, vegetables, fruits, tortillas, and let them eat bugs. Then the eggs are very saturated. I've looked up the degree of polyunsaturated fats in eggs over the last, I think it was 80 years. And there's a tremendous, the commercial eggs are now mostly polyunsaturated fat, where 100 years ago they were extremely saturated. So I've reduced my U.S. egg consumption to one per day, figuring that I can count on detoxifying some of the PUFA.
Yeah. So I wonder, farmers markets around the country, you can find farmers that, you know, range feed their chickens, but sometimes they have to supplement. And you can find farmers that are doing good organic grains with no soy, even here in Dripping Springs, if you can believe it, no soy. Now, are those grains, even if they're well-tended organic grains, are they adding to the PUFA in the eggs?
Yes, and you want to check the box to see that they haven't given them flax or any of the omega minus 3, because those make the egg taste fishy.
Ew. So you want to make sure there's no flax. What else in the feed that they don't want? You know, just omega 3 stuff, right?
I don't know if it's even legal to put fish meal in, but for a while they were getting fish additives.
Yeah. So this is a good question. Yeah, you've been talking so much about PUFAs, Mr. Pete. Can you just list some of the most active and popular PUFAs that people are consuming?
Oh, fish oil, krill oil, fatty fish. People advocating salmon, but I stopped eating salmon 45 years ago, I guess. Then the various cooking oils, soy, corn, safflower oil, all of the highly unsaturated oils should be avoided perfectly.
So salmon's a fatty fish?
Yeah.
Oh, man. A lot of people eat salmon.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Is avocado filled with PUFAs as well? Says Lynn, which is the best liquid oil to cook with and the best oil to consume on salads besides olive oil? Good question there.
If the avocado oil comes from the seed, it's pretty saturated and safe.
Mm-hmm.
But if they use the whole fruit, that would be very unsaturated. So I think you shouldn't eat a lot of fresh avocados regularly.
Hmm. And so, and she's asking the best liquid that you like to cook with? Oil, sorry.
I use a little olive oil for some foods, quite a bit of butter for frying eggs, and for frying chicken wings, for example, saturated hydrogenated coconut oil is ideal.
Adam, are you familiar with what Ray Pete's talking about, this hydrogenation of coconut oil? I know you like coconut oil.
Yes, I am. Definitely a lot of the coconut oils in the health food store are not pure oil. So at the very least, you get a pure oil, which Ray Pete used to get, if I remember right, from some company. But now the hydrogenated oil, I understand that he's gone to. It's been my experience, because the coconut oil that's called virgin coconut oil often in the health food store, contrary to popular belief, because there are some PUFAs in there, it does go rancid. So I'd definitely take Dr. Pete's advice.
Ghee, too, right, Mr. Pete? That's a good one. Isn't it ghee?
Some what?
Ghee?
Oh, ghee, yeah, that's fine. Fresh butter, it's just a way of concentrating the fat from butter, but I actually like the taste of fresh butter better than ghee, but ghee is nutritionally
just fine.
Good.
Yeah. Does Mr. Pete have an opinion about the TSH level? So many people vary on their numbers that they go by. That would be a determination for a low thyroid.
The problem with TSH is that the medical profession practically totally ignores the factors that regulate TSH. When you're under stress, the stress hormones lower it, so you can look like you're hyperthyroid. You can have 0.005 on your TSH and seem to be a hyperthyroid person, but it could be your stress hormones lowering it. And if you don't measure the stress hormones and your T3, reverse T3 is also increased by those same stress hormones. So people are being diagnosed as hyperthyroid when they're extremely stressed and hypothyroid with very low real T3 relative to reverse T3. So you have to measure several things at the same time to know what the TSH means. I've never seen a person who really felt good whose TSH was as high as 2.0. And people are healthiest when their TSH is 0.4 or less.
Wow, that's pretty low. Wow.
Yeah, the range has been adjusted down over the years, but then a couple of years ago, some pressure was exerted and they reversed and went back up for a while. But the safe range seems to be now recognized by quite a few experts as 0.2 to 2.0.
I'll be darn. That's pretty low. This is a good question. John says, Patrick has talked from time to time and had an interview a fellow up in Pennsylvania, from Birkenhead, Pennsylvania, Amos Miller, where you can actually buy fresh thyroid from well-tended cows. Would Mr. Pete think it's a good idea to eat some of those?
You want to recognize the potency, though.
Yeah,
when it,
boy, baby,
when it's
strong.
Actual, 1 gram of dehydrated gland is equal to 15 grains of thyroid. I knew someone who liked chicken necks when he worked on the farm, and on the day they had chicken, he would eat 5 necks. And he said that afternoon he was always too hot to work very well. he was getting about 5 grains in one meal, and that can make you overheat. So 1 grain would be 15, 1 gram of dehydrated beef thyroid would be equal to 15 grains of the medical.
Oh, I see. So 1 gram of like a beef thyroid, if it's fresh or whatever it was, equals 15 grains desiccated, right, of desiccated.
Yeah, so you want to divide it into 15 portions.
Yeah, be pretty careful there, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Please ask Mr. Pete what a person should do who's had their thyroid radiated. Oh, boy.
Then you need to take thyroid. Probably the healthy young person's gland produces about 4 grains of thyroid per day, the equivalent. And doctors will often supply only thyroxin, only T4, and that will suppress your TSH down to 0, but you aren't necessarily getting any thyroid function from that because it depends on a good sugar supply and selenium for your tissues to convert T4 to the active T3. So using a glandular thyroid or the equivalent, such as Xenoplus or Thyrolar, you should think in terms of a healthy person being able to produce 4 grains per day. You can usually maintain a good function at 2 grains, but just in case symptoms show up, you shouldn't resist taking the full 4-grain supplement. Armour Company used to make lots of 5-grain tablets, and veterinarians generally recognized that Cocker Spaniels often needed a 5-grain tablet, even though they weighed maybe 50 pounds. Lots of human patients required 5 grains. I knew a couple people, one woman who was very sick for about 30 years. Her hips were about a yard wide, and she had to use a walker, could barely get around. She found a doctor who would prescribe 5 grains, and she improved so much over a couple of months. She went to another doctor and got an additional 5 grains, and on 10 grains supplement, she was almost well. She found a third doctor, and taking 15 grains a day in just 2 or 3 weeks, she was totally healthy and got a job. And after 30 years of extreme hypothyroidism, that was apparently because her liver had been poisoned so that she wasn't able to convert the T4 component. And with 15 grains of Armour thyroid, she was really getting the equivalent of a good 4-grain function.
Now, do I understand, is a grain, that's 60 milligrams?
60 or 61.
Wow. I mean, so the body makes, what, 240 milligrams of healthy thyroid?
When a healthy person is working well, it can make that much.
Well, what does Mr. Pete think about collagen from bone broths? Good for us?
If you don't use the marrow, avoid the long bones. Use just the joints so that there's a lot of cartilage and ligaments. Those are the source of the gelatin. Yeah. Very little comes out of the bone itself.
Oh, you mean like chicken feet and stuff like that? They have a lot of collagen.
Chicken backs and necks and skin and wings. Those are the greatest chicken soup.
Mm. Are the cosmetic companies that Mr. P talked about adding LDL, HDL, or a combination to their skin creams?
I assumed that they were just using a fairly refined cholesterol rather than the actual stuff out of the bloodstream.
Yeah. Here's from Don in New Jersey. Do you think NAD IV treatment is safe? NAD? Never heard of that one.
NAD?
NAD IV treatment, right.
Niacin amide raises your cellular NAD, and that's what you want. But if you inject things intravenously, I think you're risking reactions en route to the cell. Niacinamide is taken up, and the cell does no harm in the cell, and is converted to NAD, so that you can raise it in a safe way.
Leslie is in Sacramento. Supposing we're on a good, well-balanced, totally organic diet, are there supplements that Mr. Ray Pete suggested that we should be taking just because we need them? Good question.
It depends on what's in your diet.
Yeah.
Often people will include green salad and whole grain bread and maybe legumes and some things that are high in toxins. The number of people who are chronically sick because they're eating green salads, it's amazing. I've seen people get well from chronic problems just by leaving out their green salads.
Well, what's with the lettuce? What's going on?
It's the defensive chemicals in the leaf. They aren't as intense as in the seed, but they are designed to block digestive enzymes in the grazers, cows, goats, and insects and worms and things that would eat their leaves get poisoned unless they, like a cow, have a rumen to detoxify those. And people don't have the detoxifying system, and so their digestive enzymes are simply blocked by the chemicals in the leafy greens. Unless you cook them thoroughly, that breaks down a lot of the toxins.
Yeah. So that's the argument for a lot of people, Ray Pete, of cooking vegetables rather than raw. I know my grandma used to, she'd say, oh, yeah, you should cook your lettuce. You know, don't eat it raw. Cook your lettuce. She lived to 96 and never was sick a day in her life.
She
knew.
Yeah, she knew, even without reading the research, apparently.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. Here's a lady that... she's got swollen ankles a lot, knees, and both knees have knobs sticking out. I've also have a pregnant-looking belly fat, and the wrists and knees are about 2 years old. And I'm wondering if Mr. P would suggest like progesterone and maybe thyroid product for potential benefit.
The basic problem is usually that a low thyroid person has slow digestion, and so foods are feeding bacteria in the intestine. Bacteria produce endotoxin, and if your intestine is irritated and hypothyroid, you absorb that endotoxin into the system along with some allergens. So the combination of low thyroid and slow digestion will cause various inflammatory degenerative processes. When you're low thyroid, you aren't converting cholesterol to the protective hormones. So if your cholesterol is very high, that means you're probably deficient in those protective hormones like progesterone and pregnenolone and DHEA. And I've seen people supplement, like a woman came visiting from Sweden to give lectures in Eugene, and she had, I think it was two joints replaced, and was about to have knee and shoulder replacements because all of her joints were getting so deformed. She spread progesterone over all of her body and spent two or three days in Eugene walking around seeing the sights with absolutely no joint pain.
I'll be done. Gail writes in, I'm taking 90 milligrams of pig thyroid, and I feel good. I just wonder if I take it ongoing that it's harmful, or will my thyroid ever get back to doing things normally without the pig thyroid?
People have experimented with that, experimentally giving higher and higher doses of a supplement, watching what is happening with the gland's output. They would increase the dose until the thyroid shrank and stopped producing. And then they would stop the dosing and measure the return. And it's almost immediate. I've seen people who could feel a stretching sensation when they were changing their thyroid dose. Once I was supplementing a full 4-grain dose, and I noticed that I had indentations beside my Adam's apple where my thyroid had been. So I stopped taking it. The very next morning, my neck was smooth. The gland had enlarged enough to fill out those empty spaces. So it's extremely fast at coming back when it's needed.
So what are some of the key things that people should do in lifestyle or diet if they want to start trying to cut down on the pig thyroid and get this baby working again? What would be some things that they would play with to not so they don't feel terrible, you know, during the process?
Vitamin D is extremely important. It works right along with the thyroid to regulate sugar, because calcium regulates everything and vitamin D is an important calcium regulator along with thyroid. And people sometimes are depressed or have other nervous symptoms just because they're vitamin D deficient. Mm-hmm. But vitamin D, part of what it does is to suppress the parathyroid hormone.
Oh.
When you're low in calcium and vitamin D, the parathyroid hormone tears the calcium out of your bones to keep your blood level where it should be or higher. And that causes many degenerative symptoms. And eating about 2,000 milligrams of calcium per day, I think, is pretty close to ideal if your vitamin D is also up around the middle of the range on the blood level.
So what else? Can we get enough vitamin D from the sun, in your opinion?
Yeah, mm-hmm. But if you're over 50, your time in the sun has to be much longer than when you were younger. And it takes from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. in the United States is usually the only time that you're going to get like a whole body exposure. In 30 minutes, you can do it right at the middle of the day.
And you want to get on the skin, right?
Yeah, it has to be directly onto the skin.
So to boost up thyroid function while you're cutting back, you mentioned vitamin D, calcium, anything else?
Enough good sugar in the diet.
Sugar.
That's why I recommend orange juice.
Ah.
A quart or two of orange juice is very supportive to your thyroid.
That'll be done. Adam, what's your... Didn't you say orange juice at a certain time is the best thing for the thyroid? What was it, 9 o'clock at night or midnight?
Well, I usually take it in the morning, but it's good anytime. And I can tell you one thing, that oranges, I won't go into details, changed my life. It was one of the most important things I learned from Ray Peet. I've been eating one almost every day for 6 years since I first heard Ray Peet.
I'll be darned.
A couple of people have told me that their melanoma disappeared or got under control when they started drinking a lot of orange juice.
But see, I've always heard, you guys, that, oh, there's just so much sugar in orange juice, you don't want to drink orange juice, you know.
There are advertising conspiracies against salt and sugar.
Yeah. Does Ray Peet have any opinion on John Elliswater from Maggie in New York?
No, I don't know what it is.
I don't know what that is either. Do you know what that is, Adam, John Elliswater?
No. By the way, on a kind of an offbeat question, a friend of mine will not forgive me if I don't ask this.
Okay.
What does Ray Peet think about pleomorphism?
Pleomorphism? Is that like an other thing, another earth, other than earthly being, you know, on Prime Video? Or what is pleomorphism?
Apparently, a bacteria can change into a virus, vice versa, and other things like that. And anyway, a friend of mine would like the answer to that.
There is a lot to that, but the particular practitioners, I think, drove it into the ground by trying to sell their particular treatments. But there are various alternative forms, and it relates to a bigger question. We actually have pleomorphic cells, stem cells in our tissues, which are pleomorphic in the sense that they are pluripotent. They can develop into what we need unless we're poisoning them with PUFA and heavy metals and radiation. Our tissues should be able to change form as needed. Incidentally, when you eat a particular food like beef or chicken or fruit, you are absorbing and integrating some of their DNA into your own structure. And that increases, I think, in the long run, our capacity to produce the changes that we need. We have only about 5% of our DNA is really in use, and we have that big reserve that we can draw on under stress.
Interesting.
I've heard that they call that horizontal DNA versus the vertical DNA.
Right. Yeah.
You guys are geeks with horizontal and vertical, man, I tell you.
Horizontal transmission of DNA.
Here's a good question. Leon, late at night, I have a very, very slight teeth chattering, and not because I'm cold. Does Ray Pete have an opinion on what could be the cause and the cure of that one?
I think that's, again, the adrenaline.
Oh, the adrenaline.
And sugar and salt and calcium, milk and vitamin D are behind the thyroid function to keep your blood sugar steady.
So let's see. So he could increase the sugar and salt, and that would lower adrenaline, which would increase thyroid, and then lower that down. So that you think it's the adrenaline hit that's the teeth chattering.
I think it is.
Interesting. Lynn wants to know, what digestive enzymes would be helpful for eating more raw foods or even cooked foods?
Nothing. Well, you could eat fungal enzymes to break down cellulose and such, but the problem is that you get traces of the fungus along with the enzyme. So I think it's better to try to not break down cellulose in your intestine. The cellulose is having a good function to sort of sweep things along, help them not be reabsorbed. Your liver excretes toxins into the bile, and if you have fiber moving through your intestine, that will prevent that toxin being reabsorbed so that you can excrete it.
Interesting. Here's a good... people are hearing a lot of so much about too much stomach acid, not enough stomach acid. You know, after Jonathan Wright did his whole thing, well, everybody over 50 doesn't have enough stomach acid. They should take HCL or apple cider vinegar. What's your experience with it in research? And would there be a reason why just because somebody is 50, 60, or 70, revolutions around the sun or age, that they would just not have enough stomach acid to do their thing?
The thyroid is really the source of acid.
There you go, back to the thyroid again.
Wow. Yeah, oxygen is named, means the source of acid. Thyroid acidifies your tissue with carbon dioxide production, carbonic acid, and that should keep your cells inside acidic and outside relatively basic. And the stomach depends on that carbon dioxide production to produce the hydrochloric acid.
Fascinating.
And so inability to use oxygen and thyroid increases with age because of the PUFA and heavy metal accumulation. And so getting your thyroid metabolism right will usually improve all of your digestion, including the acid.
Interesting. So maybe a lot of this low acid stuff that we're hearing is all coming back to this plethora or just epidemic proportions of underactive thyroid.
By the tests that were used up to 1940, easily 40% of the American population is hypothyroid. Just by the medical standards up to 1940. Then the drug companies got involved, sold their phony tests, like the protein-bound iodine test in the late 1940s, convinced everyone who had been taking thyroid, they showed normal on that test, and so they stopped taking thyroid. Doctors taught everyone that the reason they're fat and lethargic is because of their bad character, rather than low thyroid, because the test showed they were normal. 20 years later, that test was shown to be absolutely unrelated to thyroid function. So for 20 years, people were indoctrinated to believe that 95% of the population has good thyroid function, where it was a phony test. But on the basis of that belief that only 5% might be hypothyroid, The new tests, TSH, is meaningfully related to thyroid, although ambiguously, but those new tests were interpreted in terms of the 95% not needing thyroid. So no matter how good a test it is, if your assumptions are wrong, the test isn't going to do you any good.
So if we take supplemental iodine, Lugol's or detoxified, the Edgar Cayce thing, does that help the thyroid function?
No. Over the years, it's likely to make it worse.
Oh, good.
Most iodized salt is usually around the world where they have iodized the salt, they see increased thyroid gland degenerative conditions, increased nodules, inflammation, Hashimoto's disease, and so on. You can produce it by just a moderately excess of iodine.
So you're not, I take it then, you're not a supporter of taking a supplemental iodine at all?
No. Okay. Seafood, once a week, eating seafood gives you all the iodine you can use.
And again, you said the low-fat, I've written it down, but the low-fat fish are cod and sole?
Sole.
Cod and sole. Wow. Is there an adrenal supplement we can take to lower the adrenal problem, writes Robert?
If you're on a farm, the adrenal gland is very good nutritionally. It contains pregnenolone, and a small supplement of pregnenolone, if you can find a safe source, which I can't. But pregnenolone used to be a good, reliable support for adrenal problems.
But it's hard. You can't find a clean one, Mr. Pede?
Everyone is tending, women get breast pain or uterine cramps from it, which means it's probably contaminated with estrogens.
Mm-hmm. George wants to know, what's Mr. Pete's opinion on hemp plant and the hemp oils or the hemp protein? Are these worth looking at?
Protein is okay.
The hemp protein?
You have the seed protein problem. It should be properly processed. Lime processing would make it more digestible. But the oils are highly unsaturated, so I think it's good to be very cautious with them.
They're poofers. Linda wants to know what the negative effects of flax seeds. Are there negative effects in flax seeds?
The high polyunsaturated is the main problem. There are some good components, but some bad. Most people who use the flaxseed as a laxative or bulk are absorbing very little of the substance. So if you're using it as a bulk fiber, it's okay. You aren't absorbing much of the bad stuff.
They have some good, theoretically good organic psyllium husk kind of fiber things. And are those reasonable things to take?
Some people are
do okay with them.
Some people do very well. Others get more constipated with it, so you have to try out the fiber. Cooked bamboo shoots are good, safe fiber for most people. Well cooked mushrooms work for fiber for lots of people.
I'll be darned.
Raw carrots worked for me for about 20 years, but then I developed bacteria that could eat the carrots, apparently.
Dom wants to know, is there any way to regrow teeth enamel?
Only in the most superficial sense. Before it has penetrated to the dentine, the proteins of the enamel can capture calcium from the environment and reconstitute the seal. But once it has entered the dentine, then it should be treated with a filling of some sort.
Mm-hmm. A couple more, then we'll let you go, Mr. Pete. You've been very generous with your time. Thank you. We really enjoy this. So would drizzling a bit of lemon juice on a salad help to break down the anti-digestive toxins in the raw greens?
No.
No? Doesn't do it.
Nope.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you mentioned about the raw vegetables. You know, in Ayurvedic medicine, I'm kind of a fan and studied it somewhat over the years. I'm no expert. but they're not very big on raw vegetables at all. Just nothing. Cook them, they say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 5,000-year-old method, so maybe on to something. Are scrambled eggs, cooked eggs, poached eggs, any different?
Raw eggs are nutritionally very, very good. They have an antiviral effect in the intestine, the fresh form. But cooked, they're extremely nutritious, except for the cumulative effect of the PUFA.
Oh, you mean it just depends on their diet, and you got to be really be careful about that. Well, Mr. Pete, it's been so much fun having you on. Thanks. We won't wait so long. Would you come back again sometime?
Oh, sure. Anytime.
Oh, that'd be great. It'd be fun to have you on. Adam, do you have anything else you'd like to say or ask Mr. Pete or whatever?
One more thing.
Go ahead, Ray.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
One more thing about to validate the DHA thing is that a salmon is lucky. It's high DHA, and it's lucky if it lasts to 9 years. An orange ruffy is the lowest fish of all in DHA, and it lives to 149 years.
Really? The orange ruffy does? And that's
I've heard 300 years.
That's oh, come on. A fish can't live 100 years, can they?
Oh, sure.
Really?
Yeah, some of I'm sure some are older than that.
Isn't that amazing? So the salmon only lived. Well, salmon though, that they swim upstream and get girls and stuff. I mean, you know, no wonder they die early. You know,
when they feed fish oil, they lose endurance and age quickly.
I'll be darned. Yeah, and boy, when you talk about fish too, folks, be careful about all this. You know, you go to some stores and they say responsibly farmed fish, and you have no idea what that means, right? You just have no idea what they're feeding them. I think Whole Foods has some pretty good standards, but be careful. I would suspect, Ray Pete, that wild fish Atlantic would be a good choice.
The southern fish around the equator have the least PUFA.
Oh, and which one? Oh, so they're back. Is that back to the cod and the sole?
They are still pretty high in PUFA, but you pretty much have to live in the region to get the warm water fish.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Well, Mr. Pete, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Okay.
Tell folks before you leave what they might find if they visit raypete.com.
Lots. There are about 100 articles there on all the subjects we've talked about.
100 articles. And do you have your own private kind of newsletter?
Every 2 months now.
Uh-huh.
It's $28 for 2 years.
Oh,
for 12 issues.
Man, I'm going to sign up for that guy. $28 for 2 years. God love you. That's great. And what part of the world do you live in?
Eugene right now, Oregon.
Ah, man, you're up there on the left coast.
Yeah.
Eugene, Oregon. And a listener wants to know how old you are, if you don't mind.
82.
No. Really?
Yep.
Well, you don't sound like a day over 50. That's great. 82. 82. And you're in good health? You feel good?
Yeah, I haven't been to a doctor, so I don't really know. 50 years. 50 years without seeing one.
Yeah. Our friend Adam here, he's 75 around the sun. I'm 72, and we're always kidding people. Say, okay, now when you guys start to listen to some of us folks over 70 revolutions about longevity, that's, you know, rather than the kids on YouTube who are 30 telling you how to live a long time, it's funny. They all mean well, though. They all mean well. Well, Mr.
Pete is an artist, too.
You are? What do you paint, Doc?
There are some of my pictures from 20 years ago are up on my website.
Great. Well, we'll keep in touch. We'd love to have you back anytime, and thanks for being here this morning.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ray Pete. Well, Mr. Adam, thank you for being here. That was fun, huh?
It was. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, yeah. It was great. Great having you guys on. And he's quite. I had no idea that he was 82 revolutions around the sun. Man.
Yeah, he's doing great, too.
Yeah.
I like that he doesn't know how healthy he is because he hasn't been to a doctor to get it validated.
That's right. That's right. That's the way it goes, man. All right, brother. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your ongoing support. And we really lost a good one with Andrew, right? Wasn't that pretty amazing?
We did. Quite a shock. But like Donald Lay said, like it or not, we all survive our decent burial.
We all survive our decent burial. We sure do. Okay, Adam, we love you. Say hi to Vibrant Gal. We'll probably be connecting with you during open phones tomorrow.
Love. You bet.
Okay, bye-bye. Patrick Timpone, Andrew, I'm just thinking about Andrew. Ray Pete and Adam Bergstrom will have this show up on the website very soon, a couple hours. And this would be a good one to pass on to everyone that you care about, especially folks with a thyroid. And I think most of us have it, unless a few of those got your thyroid nuked. But even then, he has some ideas for you. So I love you all very much again. Thank you for your outpouring of love and support with Andrew Goss going on his cosmic vacation. Suddenly, it's been just amazing. My inbox just doesn't stop, and Facebook, and well, it's just, I know the family really, really appreciates it. They heard the little show we did yesterday. They were listening, and they really appreciate all the love and support you had for Andrew. And I was just so fascinated. I know he had a big impact and had a big audience, but to the extent that people really cared about him and loved him and felt like they knew him was just, you know, I should have realized that, but boy, I sure do now. Anyway, so I love you all very much. Thanks for your ongoing support of our website. Don't forget there's over 1,200 hours of just Andrew Goss, 1,200 one-hour shows of Andrew Goss, and that'll be available to you at no cost, and you can have your education, your PhD, and financial history and the way the money deal works. And thanks for your support to all the products we promote. That's how we pay the bills and our house payment. We appreciate that you support the people that we really like. And we know so many of these people, and we really do know this source. So thanks for buying stuff through our website. I love you all very much, and I'll see you tomorrow. Open phones.